Welcome to the next instalment of the IBA's Insolvency Section podcast series. My name's Gordon Holleran and I co-chair the section's Reorganisation and Workouts Committee. I'm a partner in the restructuring team at Scottish law firm Harper McLeod, and I also head up our international team working with clients and other law firms across the globe. Today in the series we're going to take a look at the growing role of mediation in insolvency. And to discuss that with me, I'm delighted to be joined by Carolyn Jones. Carolyn is an accredited civil, commercial and online mediator and is ranked as a leader in the field by both Chambers and Legal 500. Carolyn, welcome to the podcast and thanks for your time today.
Thank you for inviting me, Gordon.
Why don't we start by going right back to the beginning? Could you tell me about your journey to becoming a full-time mediator?
Of course. Relatively conventional on the face of it. A full-time career as a solicitor, starting that straight from law school, working my way through the firms, making partner, and then taking a step sort of in the manner of retirement, directly into mediation. For me, it wasn't so obvious, actually. The path to it was quite an interesting one. I did a mix of commercial and banking litigation to begin with. That led me into insolvency from there, and I specialised in insolvency for the rest of my career in private practice. That was a mixture of litigation and advisory work, and I really enjoyed the mix of those skills, the contentious and non-contentious work. Towards the later part of my career, I undertook some management roles, and that gave me some interesting insights into life and people and what makes things work. And really at the sort of closing time of my time in practice, I steered back towards the banking world for a while and was involved in a couple of significant projects in that space. People may remember the huge furore about the mis-selling of interest rate hedging products, swaps. And I was involved in that for one of the clearing banks, but not in relation to litigation, actually. I was specifically asked to lead the complaints function and handling of that. Incredibly interesting, really stretched me in some interesting ways and gave me some additional insights. By the time that had closed out, I was seeing I was going to have to reinvent myself again if I wanted to stay in the senior sort of part of law. And I really couldn't see a way of doing that that was going to be meaningful or fulfilling for me. So I left private practice at that point, having done some very initial explorations. And I did some quite intensive coaching with a terrific lady who really, really put me through my paces. Mm-hmm. And we threw up all sorts of things as to what I might do next. A lot of them nothing to do with law and certainly not to do with insolvency. But having worked out what it was going to be that was going to make me tick and float my boat, so to speak, mediation actually did come right to the front as something that I would find fulfilling and rewarding. And thinking about it now, there were some early seeds sown in my career, actually. I did a large part of my formative work for Eversheds as a junior lawyer, and they very heavily promoted what they called early case assessment to their litigation clients. And ADR was very much alternative dispute resolution, very much part of that. And we had quite a few people specialising in that area or promoting it within the firm. And one of the biggest cases I worked on in my early years settled, not at mediation, in a very carefully choreographed series of negotiations, but it made a powerful impression on me about the benefits of settling commercially. Yeah. And that certainly wasn't the first and last time that happened in my litigation.
I suppose the mis-selling complaints must have been a kind of mediation.
Very, very, very mediation focused, or at least about approaching the customer and understanding the customer's complaint and getting to the bottom of it and seeing what could be done about resolving it in a different way. Actually, a lot of those cases then, if they began a litigation life and we weren't able to resolve it in complaints, a great many of those cases did go to mediation. I actually wasn't involved in that stage, but I have since talked to and worked with some of the people who were. But it was mentioned to me in a very early performance review in the 90s that mediation might be something I should look at and could be good at. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see that it came to fruition just a very, very long time later.
Well, you mentioned the 90s, which kind of ages us both. Because
I'm afraid it does.
I was trained as a mediator by CEDAR back in the early 90s. Yep. And at that time, there were a lot of pretty bold claims being made about how mediation was going to lead to the end of litigation as we know it and all that kind of stuff. And that certainly hasn't happened. But where do you see the position of mediation in the current kind of dispute resolution landscape in England and Wales and more widely?
Certainly established here. As you say, in the 90s we had the Wolf reforms incorporating ADR into the civil procedure rules here. And it has been used across the board, including in commercial cases. I think it's fair to say that we've seen it more strongly in family and housing and employment related matters. That perhaps remains the case. But since the 90s, parties have been obliged to follow the pre-action protocols. They've been required to state whether they consider the matter should be stayed or is appropriate for another form of resolution. They've had to say that probably more than once by the time it's got to trial. And they may well have encountered directions and steers and comments and nudges from the judges on their way to trial, encouraging them to take that route. But I do think the pace of change has been quite slow until relatively recently. Perhaps that is surprising. The number of mediators and arbitrators has grown enormously since that time. And I think it is generally more accepted by parties too. But when the MOJ put out a call for evidence in 2021, they noted that it was still very much considered alternative mediation, and that really it shouldn't be, and that it should be something more integrated into the justice system if possible. And very clearly in the report which preceded that, the ground was laid quite firmly for the changes that we've seen recently. Senior members of the judiciary are leading the way to get mediation to happen more. Yeah. It clearly stated in the call for evidence introduction that too many cases were still coming to court unnecessarily, and that we really needed a change. Some part of that, I imagine, is driven by constraints on funding for the justice system. Mm-hmm. But I think also in the sense of, as it's been put, saving parties from themselves, and that the courts should have more power to make that happen, to save the system and save the parties.
Yeah. And I think, I mean, we don't tend to use the term ADR as much as we used to do. And I think, is that because the kind of word alternative suggests wacky or...
Yes, indeed.
Non-normal.
Yes. The trouble is that the alternative versions or the ways of describing that, unless you name the process mediation, arbitration, actually quite a mouthful. You try saying non-court-based dispute resolution too many times, it does not roll off the tongue. I don't know about you, but I find that tricky. So I rather fear that we'll be talking about ADR for a while yet.
Yeah.
Just a shorthand for what we really mean.
Yeah, sure. Now, at the end of last year, towards the end of last year, a Court of Appeal judgment was issued, which there was a lot written about, and I think is seen as perhaps having quite a fundamental impact on the use of mediation in England and Wales. Could you tell me more about that?
Yes, of course. You mean the decision in Churchill?
I do, yes.
Yes. Big news.
Yep.
Big news in litigation, big news for mediation. A decision for which the ground, as I say, had been very carefully laid, including in the Law Commission report that was published ahead of the call for evidence. A very strong Court of Appeal, set deliberately, as in very senior judges on the panel, very deliberately full argument, invited full argument. There were a lot of interveners, as in third parties who weren't necessarily part of the litigation, but were there to help the court fully examine the ramifications if they were going to make some changes to the law or state more clearly what the law has always been, depending on your preference.
sort of like bodies like the Law Society?
The Law Society, some of the mediation representatives, you've mentioned CEDA, they were involved.
Okay.
The Bar Council, some of the Housing Association representatives as well. So a very broad breadth of interest and a range of submissions. Not all of the interveners actually addressed the court directly. The Law Society and the Bar Council took largely the lead on making the representations, yep. But they were collated so that the court had the benefit of the fullest range of views. And actually, I should mention the IBA put out its own press release and comment about Churchill, I think in December last year. It might be something members would like to pick up. But the real purpose of the decision in Churchill, or the Court of Appeal's mission, was to revisit a previous decision of the Court of Appeal, which is generally referred to as Halsey, which had set a sort of benchmark for the time being, at least, that it was inappropriate for the courts to order parties to go to mediation, and that may be in breach of parties' rights under Article 6 of the European Convention on Human Rights, the right to access to a full trial. That if parties were being stayed, were being pushed into mediation, and their cases were being stayed for that purpose, they were not getting the access to trial that they perhaps should have.
Which was always a bit difficult to understand for me, because they did have the right to come back.
Indeed.
To court.
Yes. And things have moved on, I think it's fair to say, in the litigation landscape generally, and judicial thinking. And in fairness to him, Lord Justice Dyson, who gave the leading judgment in Halsey, had begun to row back quite openly and publicly on whether that was really the right way to think about it in the sort of modern landscape, and influenced as well in some of the public discussion, and you can read more about this in the Law Commission report that I've mentioned, looking across globally and seeing mediation being used, and in some cases being used compulsorily, I think that's better, and the adoption of the Singapore Convention for the recognition and enforcement of settlements at mediation, which a lot of countries in the world have signed, ratified, adopted. The UK has signed it now. It's not fully ratified yet, but it's going through our parliamentary process. And you've got to be mindful of what's happening globally when you're considering what your interests, the litigants in your own country are. Italy, I think, has notably made it a mediation portal that you've got to go through before you're really starting to litigate, for instance. And the conclusion of the Court of Appeal's deliberations was sort of twofold, really. First, that although the Court of Appeal had said something different in Halsey, the comments made in the judgments in that case were not determinative or necessarily determinative of the actual decision, which was really about costs. It wasn't really about ADR, it wasn't really about mediation. And so future courts could treat it as not binding. So for the lawyers who are listening, it's obiter, not part of the ratio of the case. And the Court of Appeal ruled that the court can lawfully stay proceedings for the parties to engage in a non-court-based dispute resolution process, and the court can order the parties to participate in such a process, provided three important things. First, the order does not impair the very essence of the claimant's right to a fair trial, fundamental part of Article 6 rights. Also, that it's made in pursuit of a legitimate aim, and that it's proportionate to achieving that legitimate aim. The court, it therefore follows, will not always order parties to try a different process or even stay the litigation for them to explore it. And the Court of Appeal was very clear that this was going to be a fact case-specific exercise every time it came to be considered, which does build in quite a lot of checks and balances for parties, actually, when you think about it. But also, it wasn't going to issue a checklist for judges to use. There were some pointers given from Halsey itself and from submissions made in front of the Court of Appeal in Churchill, But it was made very clear that those are not definitive and that the judges should feel that they can actively manage the case and help and support the parties in whatever way is most appropriate. One of the final things to say about Churchill is that actually it wasn't a case about mediation.
All right.
In fact, Mr. Churchill's complaint was made against his local authority, and he said that he had an invasive weed on his land and that that had encroached onto his land from land that belonged to the local authority nearby. And he thought the local authority should have done something about it, and they hadn't, and they'd therefore caused him this problem because now it had spread to his place. And he raised the complaint with them initially. Their first response was, "We hear you, but this should go to our internal complaints handling process. And if you issue proceedings and you don't come to that process first, we will ask for a stay in the litigation so that we can use that process and hopefully avoid the costs of litigation." Mr. Churchill was not enamoured of the idea. He really didn't like that suggestion at all for a whole range of reasons and complaints that he had about what he thought the process would involve. And he wanted to get on with the litigation that he had started. And he came in front of a deputy district judge at the first time of asking, and the deputy district judge concluded that his hands were tied by the Halsey decision, because that was a Court of Appeal decision and appeared to be binding on him, so he thought. And had he not considered that, it seemed quite likely that he would have ordered the stay. But he felt he couldn't do that because of the Halsey decision being in the way. Yes. And so the Churchill case was fast-tracked by the judge who gave permission to appeal to the Court of Appeal because it produced an important point of law that needed deciding. And of course, this was the case, or the type of case, that the courts had been waiting for.
Yeah.
So that they could finally grapple. I'm not sure I can put it quite that firmly, but they were certainly very pleased to have the opportunity to revisit it. Reading the Court of Appeal judgment myself, I'm left wondering whether in fact Sir Geoffrey Voss, the Master of the Rolls, who gave the leading judgment in Churchill, himself would have ordered the parties to go to the complaints process. But I do wonder whether as a different form of order he might have ordered them to go to mediation or stayed for mediation.
Yeah.
He certainly concluded his judgment in the Court of Appeal in Churchill by encouraging the parties in that case to consider a stay for mediation or possibly some other form of arbitration.
Rather than use of the
I wonder if that's where he would have gone with it if he'd really been left to his own devices. But actually, by the time it came to the Court of Appeal, what the counsel had asked for originally, which was a month stay to pursue the process, he concluded that wasn't really going to be useful or practicable any longer. Things had gone too far, and that it should continue down the litigation track. But he did give a very clear steer to the parties that he thought they should be exploring something different, and leaving it to them effectively what they wanted to do from there.
And I presume the effect of that decision is likely to be that there's going to be an increasing number of mediations in England and Wales over the coming period. Is that right?
I would think so. I'm sure that's what the Court of Appeal will be hoping. I'm sure it's what the senior judiciary and the government will be hoping. And I think it's realistic to expect that parties are going to see this decision, conclude that they're likely to be on the wrong end of an order asking them to do this at some point if they continue, and bite the bullet and do it at their own volition and their own timing without feeling under pressure and at an appropriate point that suits them, rather than waiting to be told.
Yeah, so not lots more orders to go to mediation, but people going to mediation because they know that it's likely to be ordered if they don't agree.
That's my expectation. Having said that, I don't think it'll be too long before we see some form of relevant order following Churchill directly being made in some form of litigation. It might not be insolvency litigation, but when I checked a couple of days ago, the decision had been referenced a couple of times, but not in connection with specifically a stay or an order to mediate. What the government has done in relation to small claims of under £10,000 here is put compulsory mediation in the path of litigants. In fact, what's being used as part of that process is not something that perhaps you or I would recognise as mediation. It's not going to follow the format of a day's mediation with the mediator in preparation and papers and so on. It's going to be a much quicker triage on the phone, a few hours of to-ing and fro-ing. But nonetheless, it's compulsory. It's being called mediation or some form of other resolution process, and it'll be interesting to see how that gets on.
Yeah, very. So what you're talking about there is a situation where probably over the last 30 years or so there's been a steady growth in the use of mediation for commercial disputes, and now the Churchill decision, which is likely to lead to even more increased growth.
Exactly so.
Can we now focus on the use of mediation in relation to insolvency disputes? And obviously with your background in insolvency in private practice, that's something you're uniquely able to speak about. In your experience, is mediation a suitable method of resolving insolvency disputes? And where have you seen it used in cases?
It certainly can be. It absolutely has been the right answer in some of the insolvency work that I have done. I see a lot of office holders' claims against directors. That perhaps won't come as a surprise to anybody. These days, that tends to be framed in terms of claims for breach of the creditor duty, preferences, transactions at undervalue, I see often. In this jurisdiction, that's coming off the back of the office holder's ability to pursue directors for misfeasance. So using the summary process and remedy that's available under our insolvency legislation, which leads to a quicker and brisker resolution potentially than it might do in a normal Part 7 type litigation trial, full trial process. And perhaps that's been a reason why it's not been quite so mediation heavy, because actually until recently you also had the express trials pilot that was going for some time. So the office holders have access to something brisker and more effective even within the court process. But nonetheless, I've also seen wrongful trading claims and claims to recover amounts due on directors' loan accounts and employment benefit trust claims and claims to recover unlawful dividends, and all of those have proved perfectly amenable to a mediation solution. I think when parties have to issue using a regular Part 7 process, either because they're using a very specific area of our insolvency legislation, so Section 423, transactions defrauding creditors, or where the claim has been assigned to someone other than the office holder, we've perhaps seen more cases coming to mediation before issue, because the court fee is so much heavier under that regime, and because some of what the parties have to do to progress the litigation is more onerous and more time-consuming and more difficult. But I think that's a trend generally too, even outside of insolvency, is people coming to mediation before issue to see if they can reach some kind of resolution. And it makes sense commercially for that to happen, I think, in insolvency, because the IP has an opportunity to make a compromise only between the directors and the office holders. If he's going to involve a funder later, or if he's going to assign the claim to a claims acquirer, he's going to be taking a compromise position anyway. So you may as well explore that before you get to involving a third party, and keep all of the benefit for the estate. So,
and I think that is relevant to mention, in that many of these claims now are funded by specialist insolvency litigation funders. And do you think that's likely to lead to increased use of mediation to resolve these kind of...
I think it already is, Gordon, actually. All of the funders, and especially the claims acquirers that I talk to or I work with, are very clear that they are massive fans of mediation. And, I mean, for example, Manolet is firmly on the record as saying that they're very, very supportive, and that it fits with their business model and their expectations of how things are best resolved. And you can see that that makes good sense for them. Equally, in fairness, I will also say they are very public about the fact that they are willing to take cases to trial, and you see them do that.
Yeah.
So it's not that they are going to capitulate on every case, but they actively see that it can make sense.
I'm sure they would want you to make that clear.
No, quite. What I see a bit less of, in fact, I haven't been asked to help yet at all, is a liquidator's claim against administrators for the conduct of the administration whilst the administrator's been in office.
And that's a trend too. We're seeing more of those in my jurisdiction. There was one concerning the conduct of the Glasgow Rangers administration.
There was indeed.
Close to the heart of many.
Quite. And you don't have to look far in the law reports to see some examples of those cases that you can't help think would have been better resolved at mediation, actually. I'm hopeful that I will see that, and it may be that Churchill helps me with that. It would be interesting, and I would like to do that very much. I also have yet to see anything to do with restructuring plans. And I see the scope for those when I read the law reports about sanctioning.
Yes.
And setting up the plan correctly and deciding who's going to fall into which classes and all of that kind of thing. And some of that skirmishing also seems to be pretty challenging. I'm concluding it's going to be pretty expensive, and I can't help but wonder whether one or two of those could usefully come to mediation for a brisk resolution too. I talk to people about that. I make my own gentle inquiries to see whether there's anything doing there. It'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yes, and I think in my jurisdiction in Scotland, I mean, I've not been involved in any restructuring plans, and the reason for that is that we tend to be involved in cases in the SME market, and at the moment the costs of a restructuring plan just seem to rule that out for that kind of companies. And there's been some work done, I think, by R3 to try to simplify the process, and it seems to me that the use of mediation is something that could be very helpful in relation to the kind of long drawn out evidence that seems to take place in relation to restructuring plans. So maybe watch this space in relation to that. I think the other thing that I would say is that, I'm an insolvency lawyer, former litigator, and I think nowadays it's kind of hardwired into litigators to consider mediation in all disputes pretty much.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that's always been the case for insolvency lawyers, but I think with the use of funding claims and all the kind of things you've been talking about, it's likely to become a major feature of resolution of these kinds of claims against directors and all that kind of good stuff.
Music to the master of the rolls as he is.
Yes, absolutely. So just getting out the crystal ball now, looking forward, what do you think the future role of mediation is likely to be? How is it likely to develop both within this jurisdiction and globally?
Well, I think it's here to stay, but not least for the reasons you've just mentioned. And as more parties, and I would say particularly more IPs, get experience of it and see that it can deliver good results and good value for money, they will hopefully come back for more and use it more broadly. There are some cases that it's not going to be really suitable for. We could talk, for instance, about the COVID bounce back loans, very particular problem here where parties were, businesses were given support by the government during the pandemic. It turns out that a lot of people applied for that assistance in circumstances where they shouldn't have done. And the government agencies are now pursuing those people pretty vigorously. But they're doing that under the umbrella of criminal proceedings and seeking compensation orders in that context, and they're applying for directors to be disqualified and so on. And the amounts that are being claimed are, in commercial litigation terms, relatively small. So with that criminal overlay and given the amounts involved and probably taking account of the fact that the money has already gone, it's been spent, whatever, we're not going to see it again, there's not a lot for a mediator to get to grips with there. But in other aspects, potentially more settled. I mean, fraud is difficult. Fraud cases are difficult.
Because of the quasi-criminal kind of aspect of it?
Well, I think also because it's more difficult for the office holders to row back and compromise if you're really saying that somebody's defrauded the company. To what extent is it appropriate to compromise that? I've seen fraudulent trading claims, and I've seen misfeasance claims where the misfeasance is said to be so outrageous that actually it's tantamount to fraud, and I've settled those. So that isn't of itself a barrier, but emotions run higher when those accusations are flowing around. And as I say, it may be as well that you've got a very interested and vociferous creditors committee sitting behind the office holders. And if they are paying for a proper resolution, as in the maximum recovery, then that can be difficult to get around.
I suppose there's also the impact on disqualification. Sometimes I would imagine the IP would want an order.
Indeed.
For that purpose.
Exactly. But what I think we are moving away from is the misconception that signalling an intention to go to mediation is somehow a capitulation or a form of weakness. We know that's still out there in the wider world. And certainly when I started mediating about 5 years or so ago, I remember talking to a senior IP who I had acted for in practice and was hopeful that I would do some mediation with him. And he told me very clearly that he never started a case unless he was fully confident of winning it. And by winning, I assumed he meant not only getting a judgment, but recovering on it as well. And so he wouldn't be coming to mediation. It was just not going to be appropriate once he'd begun the case. I rather think that what he was driving at was that once the gloves were off, they stayed off. You're fighting. That's it. And I can see that it's more difficult to row back and explain. But you've always got the cost saving of potential litigation to use, and it may be more difficult to avoid. And if the court's going to make an order that you mediate, it immediately knocks on the head the whole question of who's blinked first and whether anybody's capitulated or anybody's shown a sign of weakness. And that may be very encouraging even in the insolvency field. But I do think as well, there are a number of reasons why mediation will not be a last resort, but will not be the first port of call for office holders. I mean, let's look at what's happening. You've got IPs leading the case, many of them very, very experienced negotiators, many of them highly commercial, absolutely focused on the issue of getting best value for creditors, well able to explore all of the investigation part of the job, to investigate what really happened. And if it makes sense to settle, then they will. And they'll be very mindful of the pre-action protocol processes. They'll be very mindful of the fact that if they don't pursue those, let's leave limitation pressures aside for one moment. But assuming there's time available, they're going to be mindful of the cost consequences of not exploring the pre-action protocols properly. So they're going to engage with those and deal with them. And so, yes, they will settle lots of cases by themselves without the help of a mediator. But there are plenty of cases that don't, I'm happy to say, and I've dealt with quite a few of those. And the more difficult ones are where the respondents actually are in difficulty meeting the claim financially.
Yes.
And I think it perhaps is easier for them to explain that to me privately in the mediation session than it is for them to admit in a round table meeting with the office holder actually present. It's not a great place for me to end up in mediation if really what I'm doing is brokering the financial settlement really on ability to pay between one room and the other. But I can still do some reasonably useful work in that respect. And as I say, it may be that it's easier for the respondent to admit to me that that's the case.
Yeah.
And that's not always the reason why they haven't settled beforehand. There's lots of other reasons, other dynamics between co-responders. There may be different dynamics introduced because there's a directors and officers insurance policy and the insurers are engaged and that's complicating things. It may be that they've just got their head in the sand. It may be that for whatever reason, in spite of all the office holders' powers, that the proper explanation of what really happened hasn't yet been offered. And it's something that I can winkle out during the mediation. But as I say, also the use of Zoom, actually, and being able to do mediation online seems to be helping some cases to come to mediation. certainly I've had, remember one IP saying to me after the pandemic that he wished he'd known about mediating online sooner.
Yeah.
That when he thought about the hours that he'd wasted hanging around, as he put it, at the IDRC here in London. Despair, really, that all the time that was spent. And if costs are a pressure and time is a pressure, then there can be some saving on that by mediating online. And although it's not my absolutely first preference, and I always like to explore with the parties whether that's really the best way of handling it, it is an additional tool, and it can make the process more viable than it would be by meeting in person.
It kind of goes against the grain for what was said to be one of the major benefits of mediation when I was training, which was getting the parties together face-to-face, eyeball to eyeball, and you know, being able to thrash out a dispute in that way. But I can see, too, that, you know, from the point of view of keeping the cost down and, you know, the kind of time spent hanging about while the mediator's with the other party, there must be big advantages in doing it by video.
There can be. If the parties will take the mediator's direction as to how best to use the process, it worked well in the pandemic because everybody was in their separate locations and they were able to be one face per screen for the mediator. Makes the job easier. What doesn't work so well is being parachuted into the end of a boardroom with a lot of people sitting around a table and you're on the screen at the end of the room. My experience, that's not helpful. But if parties will take your direction as to how to make the process work best, then it can work very well.
Great. Carolyn, thank you very much indeed. I think it's clear that for various reasons, both from the point of view of your skills as a and reputation as a mediator, but also with your background in insolvency, for the reasons we've discussed, that you're likely to be pretty busy over the next coming period. So thank you for your time today. I found that fascinating, and thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome, Gordon. Pleasure to talk to you.